This episode contains sensitive subjects like death, euthanasia, and dark humor. Please listen at your own discretion.
Our Untangled Minds by CUSM is for informational purposes only and does not constitute professional medical or psychological advice, diagnosis, and/or treatment. Please make sure if you do have any questions or concerns that are medical or psychological in nature that you seek out a physician or qualified mental health provider for further help. Furthermore, the information, viewpoints, or opinions expressed in this podcast are solely the views of the individuals that are involved. They do not represent absolute fact and are subject to change at any point in time. CUSM does not accept responsibility for these views. Lastly, the names and details of any medical stories shared in this episode have been edited for privacy.
Hello, my name is Henry Tranton, and as always, welcome to this episode of Our Untangled Minds at CUSM. For this entry, we will be talking about death. Now, given that the average age of matriculation for medical school is somewhere around 26 years old, I think it's a pretty big ask to expect the typical student doctor to be very wise or perceptive about death. Arguably, that'd actually be a pretty cruel requirement. If you're lucky, as you age through your 20s and into your 30s, a personal experience with death won't be so much as a stitch in the fabric of your life. The more downbeat moments during that time should hopefully be of a lower key. Maybe with every year, you notice that the people you love take a little bit longer to get back to you. Perhaps one day you see a few more stray hairs on your pillow and realize your forehead's a little bigger than you're used to. Or you have laugh lines that persist even when your heart's breaking. You know, the minor, more mundane spiritual deaths of the everyday. But I suppose as future physicians, for better or for worse, we don't have the luxury of time to develop our personal relationships with death naturally. With a job, death wouldn't be a few stitches in the fabric so much as the moth-eaten holes that pepper the blanket, exposing your skin to the chill of night and keeping you from a decent sleep. Which isn't to say this is all a portent of doom and predestined despair. Why would any of us invest the equivalent of a starter house in a Midwestern suburb into our medical education if that were the case? And, you know, despite my lapsed Catholic upbringing, I'm afraid I don't really recognize an inherent nobility in a life of emotional suffering. But even in a future of blood, guts, and resident minimum wage, you gotta find a way to have joy. Underneath it all, there has to be some hope. So, appropriately for this episode, we have invited here with us Dr. Helena Spartz, MD, PhD, and pathologist extraordinaire. Pathology is a field that, even within medicine, really interrogates human physiology and its relationship with death. And in leading her classes, Dr. Spartz delivers the material with a sense of good cheer and humor that has unanimously endeared her to the student population. And pursuant to that, also present is Miguel Villanueva, a fellow M2 student who is normally the erstwhile editor of our podcast, but is today co-hosting. He pitched the idea of having Dr. Spartz come on the podcast to talk about the notions of dark humor and the physician's relationship with death. So with that, Miguel, how are you doing?
Hi, I'm doing well, and I'm happy to be here.
Great. And Dr. Spartz, how are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you. I had a snack. I'm good.
That's good to know. All right. First off, a broad question. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I was born a long time ago for you guys, 1975. My favorite time was the 1980s because it was crazy and we didn't have internet.
Wow.
Pause for that. Mm-hmm. Okay. A little bit more about myself. I did go to medical school. Yeah, I did. and I did actually an MD PhD, which was horrible because I found out during my PhD that I don't like basic science research. So that was a learning opportunity for that continued for 3.5 years. I did my residency at Indiana University, which is where I also went to school. Did my residency there because there was this guy that I was dating. It wasn't quite serious, but it could have been serious, but it wasn't really serious. So like we didn't have like a ring, but kind of I was thinking, you know, so I was like, okay, I'll just do my residency here, even though I could have gone somewhere else. So it worked out because 6 months into my first year of residency, we eloped in Las Vegas, and we're still together.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what you should do. Costless. It's like $250. We got a quick deal.
It wasn't a drive-thru, right?
No, we couldn't find the drive-thru one. So, like, you know, that bums me out, too. I did want the drive-thru, but, yeah.
Unfortunate.
So, let me ask you, how did you find your way into pathology?
I stumbled upon it because I was going to go into dermatology. Everyone was pushing me, or not pushing me, they were giving me good advice, what they thought I should choose because it's a good career. And I had the research in that area and I had good grades, blah, blah, board scores, blah, blah. So that would make me sort of eligible to be able to get into derm. So then I took a derm elective. It was so gross. Like, I don't mind, like, hip joint replacements. I'm fine with that. But when somebody takes off a fingernail, creepy. It's so creepy. So, like, I found I really just didn't like skin, like, lesions and diseases. And I felt like I went to medical school. What about all those other organs I learned about? So then I realized during my PhD, I got to teach nursing students in microbiology. My PhD's in microbiology. And it was so fun. And then during my residency, I got to teach medical students pathology, and it was so fun. So then it was like, what can I do? Like, even before I started residency, I was like, what can I do where I can mainly teach? Because that's what I really like to do. I mean, like, I like to see that spark. I like to see that enthusiasm, especially before people get dead and jaded. So I like to... Henry's expression. The expression on Henry's face was one of horror.
We're getting there.
So yeah, so that's how I ended up going into pathology, because I wanted teaching to be like a big component of my career. It's really important to me. And I liked it because I didn't have to like really talk to people because people think I'm weird.
It's a good option.
The most comment I get is, weird, you're weird, but in a good way. Like, I've had so many people tell me exactly that, and I'm like, you're weird.
Do you feel like that's a personality trait that sort of helps you in terms of, like, your work as a pathologist?
I don't think being weird really helps you do anything particularly, but it's a better place to be for me to be in pathology because I don't have to put on a mask. I can be myself. Because, like, dead people are not going to talk back. They're not going to be like, you're weird. They just, I feel more connection, actually, with dead people. I feel actually a very strong connection with them. Maybe not more of a connection, but I still feel a strong, close, personal connection with somebody if they're even on my autopsy table, because to me, they're still a person. They still have a story to tell. Mm-hmm. Even though autopsy, let me just back up, it is not what you see on TV at all, unfortunately. So most of what I actually did was surgical pathology, which means surgeons are taking cancer, for example, or some other issue, biopsies, whatever. But if they're taking a cancer out, I'm the one that gets the specimen, measures the tumor, grades the tumor, all this stuff under the microscope that I've been trying to tell you guys about that's important. I try to determine if there's any markers that would be good for treatment, all those sorts of things. So I'm behind the scenes, but that's what I do. But I know for every specimen, there's a person. That's it. And then the more I look at it and if I see high grade, it affects you. But it's easier because you're objective. You're the objective person that reports back to the physician. I think it would skew my view of what I'm seeing if I knew that I had to deliver the news to the patient. So it's important to be objective.
I actually really love what you're saying about being objective. I had testicular cancer, and when I like got the pathology report back, I remember reading it.
And, oh, you got to read it? That's
good. Yeah. And looking for like the positives. So they're like, okay, stage one, like it didn't like penetrate the capsule or whatever, mm-hmm. like no invasion basically. So that was like an opportunity for hope. But I know that in the report, like the hope was, I don't know, that was me. That wasn't like the text. That wasn't the report. The report was objective. And then I still needed to do chemotherapy because there was a lymph node that was slightly enlarged. Yeah.
Did you go to Indiana University?
No.
No, actually, it's a big treatment capital for for testicular cancer. I mean, the treatment has changed. I mean, like 50 years ago, it was not a survivable cancer. So I'm really happy for you that I'm assuming you're in remission.
Yeah. Or
completely disease free.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. With just one lymph node, you'd be all right. I just say that much. You'd be all right. Thanks for sharing that.
Circling back to something you said like a little while ago, you said you like to teach students because you like to get to physicians before they have a chance to get jaded. Do you think? No. It's fair. And it allows me the chance to ask this follow-up question, so I appreciate that. Do you think that usage of humor is a way to keep physicians from getting jaded, or do you think it sort of drives them more into it?
Drives them towards jaded? I hope not. No. My actual goal is for you to see from the get-go and be prepared from the get-go. See, I really hated the way I was taught pathology. I was taught by pathologists that didn't care. They taught me as if I was a resident in pathology. I didn't get it. I didn't understand it. I had like, I was like, what does this mean? I didn't know at that time. I thought I'd be like a family practitioner. And so at the time I was like, what is this even, like, who cares, right? Who cares about a bunch of calcium clumping up on the aortic valve? So that's why I'm really determined that even though I didn't go into like a family medicine or one of those fields like internal medicine, I want to teach you guys differently from how I was taught. I want you to see it's not just the pathologic process. It's the pathologic process that causes the symptoms and disease in the patient. So I hope I'm coming across with that, because when you know the background, when you understand what's going on, then when you feel, you know, you do an exam on the patient, then I'm hoping that you can reflect back and understand the cause. Because if you don't understand the cause, when a patient does something weird, presents really weird, you can't, there's no way to backtrack and think about it cognitively, what else could be going on. I don't want you guys to be technicians. Like, that's my greatest fear. And I feel like when there's a huge disconnect between basic science and clinical science, that that's what happens. It's like, why did I have to do this basic science?
This question's kind of, it relates to pathology, but why is everything described or named in terms of food in pathology?
We're always hungry. If you've ever done an autopsy, like literally, I'm serious, okay? Like literally you're hungry afterwards. It is a lot of physical work. No, I'm serious. I mean, it's not just me. Like we all are like hungry afterwards. Sometimes we do 2 or 3 autopsies, and it's physical exertion to pull somebody's liver out. So like, or if their lungs are heavy, it's work to like cut a brain, to cut the skull off and stuff. It's a lot of like actual physical work. And afterwards, there's nothing about the smell of the body. That's completely unpleasant, but it makes you hungry. It's tiring. And so literally after we do the autopsies in the morning, we residents would just go and get food.
What's your go-to food after an autopsy?
Blueberry scones. Huh. They're really good.
So avoiding like proteins afterwards?
I don't think we thought that deeply. Blueberry scones were delicious.
So this is something in terms of like our experience as medical students right now. Going through medical school, we kind of learn a lot about pathologies and things that can like kill us personally at any age. So we're not safe ever. And we personally started feeling our own sort of sense of mortalities when we started medical school, learning of the various conditions and pathologies. And some people have termed this condition medical student syndrome. Did you ever start feeling this during your medical education?
Definitely. I definitely had liver flukes, for sure. Hands down, I knew it. I was completely confident that I had liver flukes and I was going to die from liver flukes. It turns out that might be one of those medical school, what do you call it?
Medical student syndrome.
Yeah, medical student syndrome. Everybody gets that. Mine was liver flukes. What's yours?
Oof. Pretty much the GI system was a nightmare for me just because I have a very bad diet. I eat a lot, so every time, like, something went wrong in terms of my personal gastrointestinal system, I was like, well, this is it. It's over.
This is it.
Especially since, like, I eat a lot of barbecued food. So those microsomes are going to get me eventually. Yeah. Also, in terms of MSK, I also get moles. So I was like, I see a new mole, like, oh, that's the one that's going to get me.
ABCs.
What about you, Miguel?
For me, I have my labs are high for cholesterol. And I started checking my my blood sugar, even though I don't need to. I'm not diabetic or anything, but what if I am, just in case?
I feel like as a future doctor, I'd be a bad patient just in the sense of I don't want to find out if I'm going to die. I'll just let it happen when it does.
But you're going to die.
Of course.
So we have a song that we used to play, like, We're All Gonna Die. Mm-hmm. We used to play that pretty much daily.
Oh, interesting. I guess.
We're All Gonna Die. That's the song.
I guess this is a good
it's a pretty good transition. Song because it's true.
I feel like it's a good transition to one of our questions. So in your lecture, you often joke about difficult topics like pathologies that your family has had or experienced, pathologies that you may develop or are developing with age. How do you cope with knowing that you may, you know, pretty much die from one of these diseases and know the exact pathophysiology of how it'll take you?
But we're all going to die. We're all going to die. Like, there's not really an escape mechanism for that.
Is it?
But you know, like, I know that people have a hard time with that. Like, I genuinely know that people have a hard time with that. But, like, you're going to die. And it's really conceptually difficult, right? Because we have this thing where we, you know, almost futilely do the codes and intubate people that are very, very unlikely to make it. And we do all these. And it's a huge cost for our medical system. Huge cost. Those end-of-life measures are expensive. I'm palliative care all the way. That's the way I want to go, is palliative care. Because you have to get comfortable with that. And ideally, we would help our patients be comfortable with that, but we don't. We do not.
Does knowing, like, kind of the mechanism of how, like, these diseases kill you, like, does it help you cope better or is it worse?
I don't have, like, a fatal thing just now happening. So, like, I'm coping with my osteoporosis pretty good because I can't feel it.
Yeah.
One of these days I'll fall down and then I'll be upset.
Do you think pathology as a field affords you a sort of sense of perspective or distance that other specialties might not?
Correct. Oh, you want me to expound upon that? Yeah, for sure. Like I was saying, the objectivity gives you a really different perspective. It's got to be tempting to not be completely, I think it's hard, like really hard for physicians to be honest when something really bad is going to happen to their patient.
Yeah.
I think it's really hard to be honest about that and clear in speaking about that. I think as physicians, that's a big, big issue.
Do you think it's easier for pathologists to kind of, you know, make like jokes and stuff about like death compared to other physicians? Or do you think all physicians kind of have this dark sense of humor?
Well, it's not good to be like that in front of the patient if they're not dead.
Well, but, yeah, definitely.
Like, I think humor is a really good way to handle stuff. Like, get ready, but you're going to have patients die. You can't save everybody. So what's a good coping mechanism? Mine's humor.
I was wondering, so we were talking yesterday about organ donation and making a will, and do you think that's something that like all medical students should think about or like do or like have conversations about, just so that they're like more connected to the realities of like end of life kind of stuff?
Yeah, definitely. More like the do not resuscitate. Like, really look into what that paperwork looks like. Look into how much detail you can put in it yourself, or that the patient can put in it. You don't have to just, it's not just one thing, do not resuscitate. You could do not resuscitate unless da-da-da-da-da, you know, unless it's an acute trauma, like a car accident. You can put that in there. You can put caveats in your do not resuscitate order. And you can say how far you want them to resuscitate. You can say, I don't want to be intubated. Try to resuscitate me, but I don't want to be intubated. Try to resuscitate me, but please don't shock me. Like, you know, heart shock. You guys look at me weird. Like, we don't just shock people. Like, it's, you know, I mean, it's part of the coding, right? So you can say you don't want that, but you can say it up to that point. And I think it would be good for just for you guys to, like, practice that. Like, what would you say now? And fill it out again 10 years from now. I'm not saying you got to turn it in. I'm just saying, like, you know, get it. And what would you say now? 10 years from now, get it. And wherever you're at, think about where you would, how you would fill that out. Because it changes over time. I wanted to be resuscitated in my 20s. Now I'm like, not so much. Once you see a code, once you see a real code and you see how violent it is, the chest compressions and you see the intubations and you see the shocking and you see the epinephrine, it's, I don't want it personally.
My father actually told me he had that same sort of like narrative in terms of like willingness to be resuscitated as he grew older. Because like when he was like young, when he was my age, he was like real he's real vibrant. He still is vibrant, but more so. But I remember recently in the past year, my grandmother passed like in February of 2020, and she was like in palliative care for a while. And my dad just basically said to me, yeah, just kill me before it gets that bad. And so I sort of understand that, because you sort of, as you grow older, I think you sort of find that perspective, especially as you see people have more experience with seeing people pass in worse ways.
I feel like my mom says the same thing to me. Like, she said, do not resuscitate me. If it goes down, I'll die. But that's also because she's a nurse and she sees, you know, codes all the time. So I guess it changes your perspective on things.
For sure, it'll change yours too.
Because personally, I, at this point, if, you know, something happens, I'm like, yeah, keep me alive. But I've never seen stuff like that at this point in my career.
Right. And it also, like I said, you can put all kinds of caveats as to when you would like to be resuscitated, how far that you would like it to go, etc. But if you don't have a directive like that, you will get resuscitated. That's legal for you guys. You will have to resuscitate. If they don't have the directive, you know, right there to not resuscitate, you have to resuscitate.
The thing I want to ask you is, sometimes in your lectures, you use these sort of anecdotes and personal examples that seem very personal. I think a lot of students perceive that as brave and uniquely vulnerable. And it really puts a human face on some of these conditions and helps sort of destigmatize them. Is that sort of a deliberate strategy from you?
No, I just, my family members have a lot of diseases.
Fair.
It's convenient. No, we have everything. We have like rare stuff and common stuff. Mm-hmm. I think my family's a good example for all pathologies, generally speaking.
Do you think you could ever serve as a physician for your own family members?
Oh, well, let's hope not. I'm a pathologist.
I mean, dude. In an alternate sort of reality. If you're in like a sort of primary
care. What alternate dimension are you in?
No, if you worked in primary care, do you think?
Okay, so your family members, have they done this to you where they've asked you? Oh my gosh.
No, they don't trust me.
Oh, well, that's not surprising.
It's a free doctor, so.
Yeah, but they ask you stuff and you're like, go to a doctor. So it's like, yeah, it's weird, and it'll continue to worsen as you get further.
Does that, is it make it harder for you to care for potentially sick family members? Like, because you know how bad these diseases are?
No, I am the one that gets to tell them the truth, because I feel like their physicians don't.
Oh, really?
So I tell them the truth. I also, with the full family member thing, you know, if my family members can help you guys learn something through their experience or through my own experience, that's what I want. If that makes it stick in your mind.
Have you ever found that you've may have crossed the line making, you know, jokes during
your...
Oh,
I've been told I crossed the line. Yeah. So here's the problem. You're balancing, right? And I know my sense of humor is not normal. It's weird. I'm balancing, and like, I know that some things I said to our inaugural class, they were fine with it, but I edit a lot. Like, I edited a lot before I posted y'all's videos because I just got worried, you know? Belches, really. Other things but the belches. I was like, they might think I'm unprofessional. But
is that really unprofessional when it's a
biological phenomenon? I don't know. I
feel like it's more organic.
Well, yeah, belches are organic.
It makes us feel like we're getting, I want to say, quality lecture because...
So, okay.
Your lectures are quality. I feel like you know, it'll make us laugh. It's more enjoyable that way because you can't just go through like a boring 30-minute lecture in like a monotone voice because that's hard.
Going back just a little bit, you said in terms of like sort of finding the line, how long did it take you to sort of find that line personally?
I haven't found it.
Fair enough.
I haven't. I mean, you know.
That was a good, quick shutdown of that question.
It wasn't intended to be a shutdown. It's the truth. And you guys have to find lines all the time.
Yeah.
Probably like more so than me. Because you have lines for every patient that you're going to be teetering on.
Sure.
But humor is my way of handling it. And that if I were to like take the whole cancer, every session with cancer, and if I was to take it super seriously, which it should be, right? It should be really serious. But if I was to, I would be crying the whole time. And would you guys learn as much, or do you learn more from humor? Because learning is driven by emotions. Yeah. And I learned in medical school, it was fear-based learning, right? So yours is partially because you have tests. Mine was 100%. Like, so I'm like, what other emotion can I drive the learning with? If it sticks with you because I said something funny, then I'm happy.
Okay, so in the past, death was sort of thought as failing your patient. Did practicing pathology and being surrounded by patients who have already passed away change your outlook on patient outcomes and quality of life and sort of like the notions of death with dignity in that sort of milieu?
Yeah, have you guys know what a quali is?
You can explain it for those of us who do not know.
A quality life year is a year without, a year in good health and not in poverty. Mm-hmm. That's a quality life year. So when I look at it, it's not just alive or dead. It's quality. It's qualities. It's how many life years did you get where you weren't suffering from a severe disease that you're in pain, for example, and not in poverty, because poverty is pain. So to me, when I look at the whole spectrum, it's qualities that matter to me. And that's kind of relates back to how I feel about end of life and how we treat it. It sounds weird coming from a pathologist, I guess, but that is my feel. That is my perception. It's more important that a patient has another quality life year than another year
suffering.
Suffering. I mean, obviously, that's an easy one, right?
Yeah.
But, so you make a different comparison, right? And it makes it harder, right? So, it's not as easy as saying quality versus on your deathbed in pain. It's not that straightforward, right?
Yeah.
So, it's just like, I think as population health, qualities are top of my list as opposed to keeping people alive as long as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I have things that just are weird. Keeping people alive that are dead. I mean,
yeah,
functionally speaking,
brain dead. Yeah,
physically alive, but not
physically alive and for prolonged periods.
Yeah,
again, because family members and like I get it, but somebody needed just to be honest.
Yeah,
like. Really bluntly honest, and maybe that's why people are hesitating, because they want that good personality person relationship, but you can't let the patient control every narrative if the narrative is this isn't going to go well. This is not dark humor, it's just dark. Just super dark.
Well, I guess that's what we wanted to bring out with this interview, just to like
darkness. That's terrible. It didn't even say that. It didn't say, I want to bring out the darkness in this podcast.
No, we just wanted to like have ways that you can cope with being so close to death throughout pretty much your whole life. Some people have told me, like, how are you able to deal with like being so close to death and, you know, not have it affect your mental health, basically?
So you're all going to die. I mean, like, that's the easiest way to think of it. You're not going to escape the wheel, you know? Like, once you realize that, it's like, okay, how can I make it? How can I? So for me, it's qualities. Like, how can I make this the least painful for this person?
Yeah.
So I just, like, for me, it's like it bothers me because I see the patients after they've been intubated for a long time where they're literally, like, parts of their body are rotting. Because they've been intubated for so long and they're not alive. So if you're going to be a doctor and you have somebody that says they're ready, are you going to let them go? Because I've seen a lot of residents not. A lot. When the patient is saying, I'm ready to go. And the physician doesn't want them to go. Because the physician doesn't want to be unsuccessful. Because a physician can think death is unsuccessful. What's unsuccessful about it?
Happens to all of us, eventually.
Yeah.
Right, so it gets back to the quality and where quality ends for a person.
That reminds me of Dr. Death. I remember there was a physician who was a proponent for, you know, pretty much euthanasia for patients.
What was his name?
I.
Kevorkian, that was it.
How do you feel? Do you think that's the right path to practice?
I think it happens already. I think when you have to manage the pain and you keep having to increase the morphine, you eventually go over the.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it happens.
Yeah.
And it, like, you could say unintentionally, but we know that it's gonna push the patient over the, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it's pain. It's quality of life. So I think it kind of already happens.
Yeah.
But Kevorkian was going with people who were not that far along in their disease process. So, I mean, that's the difference, I think.
I see.
And don't do that. Legally, don't do that.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, like, think about a state of mind, too.
Mm-hmm.
So what state of mind is the patient in? Because they've got this really bad news. My gosh, this is not humorous. Sorry.
No,
dark.
We appreciate it.
I stuck on the dark part. I got stuck on the dark part. But, like, it's real.
These are important, like, conversations we need to have.
Yeah, because I feel like sometimes we're just too focused. A lot of times we don't see the humanity behind medicine. We just kind of see the science. And I feel like it's important to see this.
You will.
Like you said, we're going to be that resident with that patient.
Right. I've just seen residents just do that, like, come in, you know, call them up multiple times, try to get them to come in. If the patient, you have to find a stopping point, because if the patient doesn't want it, whatever it is,
yeah.
it's not your right, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But then I'm dark.
How do you feel about the way, like, death is portrayed on TV or in the media?
Oh, it depends on the show.
What do you think portrays it the best? What do you think portrays it the worst?
I like real extreme violence. Sure. It's like that. But yeah, that's not okay. I do, because it's like blood splatter and it's just fun. It is. Because it's not real. It makes it fun. Like extreme unrealistic violence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that's sort of like the distinction, you know, like if you see someone splatter 30 gallons of blood, it's funny. If it's a realistic amount of blood, it's disturbing.
Well, if the people are crying, mm-hmm. But like, because that brings me back. Like, if you it has to be like completely unrealistic or completely funny, mm-hmm. You know, if it's really, I hate movies that are sad and that are about death. Like, I have it every day. Like, I have enough of it during the day.
Yeah.
I don't want to come home and rehash that over and over again. So, yeah, I like a lot of blood spatter. Anything where a katana blade is involved, I like.
So, sort of just to sort of like sum up, because we're running a little long. To end, do you have any sort of advice for future physicians in terms of like coping mechanisms, how to sort of like live with the day in, day out realities of the job?
You got to figure out what works for you. Mine's humor. Mm-hmm. But I have an opportunity because I'm in the background, right?
Yeah.
But you have background. You have background space. Just remember that. You have background space and you have other people.
So we'll do a lightning round. Just first thing that pops in your head.
Oh, no. Okay, I've had coffee. Okay.
What's your who's your favorite comedian?
Ronnie Chang.
Oh, okay.
Awesome.
Favorite Game of Thrones character?
Oh, that's hard. Arya. That's an easy one,
really?
Actually.
Oh.
Come on, definitely Arya. Yeah,
and she's one of the few a little bit more morally pure ones.
Like, yeah, I'll go also for had
Tyrion.
A sword.
Yeah. Like, I'm
also
sure
used a sword.
For the parents during that like Game of Thrones era, like if they named their kids after Arya, I'm guessing they were happier than if they named their kids after Daenerys.
Oh, mine's
Sansa.
Yeah,
I don't know. Mine's Bran, because he became
the master at the end.
I hate it. I'm sorry. I only watched the show in season 8, which was just awful. I'm sorry. I don't read. I just don't read.
The books. Then
you haven't.
The books are quite good.
Yeah, no.
They're excellent.
Yeah, I've heard.
You need some escapism. There's another coping mechanism. Escapism. Right. Escapism if movies would come out and not suck, because they're all really depressing now, I feel like.
Yeah.
I haven't feel like there's like any good funny movies coming out lately. And no good post-apocalyptic, nothing. It's all been just like really serious, and I'm like, I have enough seriousness in my life. So yeah. I have to go back to books.
What a shame to have to read.
No, you go ahead.
What's your favorite beer?
That's a hard one because I like so many beers. I'm going to go with Corona if I have a good lime. Mm-hmm. Only if I have a really good lime. Otherwise, it's just worthless.
All right.
Next question. What's your favorite incidental finding you've ever found like in your pathology career?
That's a good one. There's a lot of interesting things. It's usually something that's, you know, when it's unexpected. Is that what you're asking?
By whatever metric you feel like you want to go with.
You know, it's always exciting to get the right diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And when it's a rare diagnosis and you're finally the one that puts the name on it so the patient can actually be treated correctly, that feels good. So anytime that happens, you give them the right diagnosis, especially if they've been getting the wrong diagnosis for years, and you finally get a chance to look at it and you're like, I think this might be this, actually. And the patient's life changes.
Very noble answer. All right.
I'm so noble today. I'm serious and noble. This is so not like me. It's freaking me out. I want you guys to delete it. Let's do the whole thing over again.
All right. What's your favorite organ or organ system?
What? That's my problem, right? Because that's why I didn't go into derm, because I love them all. Mm-hmm. I love them so much.
And that sort of answers this next question. What's your least favorite organ or organ system?
Prostate.
Really?
I mean, it causes so many problems.
Yeah.
And I had to, we were like a GU capital because we had the testicular cancer. We had people from foreign countries come to get their testicular cancer treated there. But we had prostates, like, man, you cut up like 10 prostates a day and you're over it.
So it's more just a sense of, like, you've seen it too many times and just done.
Yeah, and it's like, to me, it's like not a very, it's not an entirely useful organ. I feel like you can pretty much live without it, right?
Can you?
Yeah, you can live with, yeah. I mean, they cut the prostate out, they don't subsequently send the body.
I haven't taken repro, so I don't know yet.
Oh, no, you can take it out.
All right. Additional question. What organ is the best to cut?
I think the liver.
Really? Is it true that the pancreas feels like butter?
Who told you that?
A surgeon.
Why were they cutting the pancreas? Don't mess with the pancreas.
Yeah, they said not to touch it because it feels like
butter. Don't mess with it. No, that's a general rule. Don't mess with the pancreas.
Okay.
Leave it alone.
I've heard it's very delicate.
Just don't mess with it. That's a general statement. Don't mess with the pancreas.
Good to know.
And that is a fact that I feel like we can end this episode on. Whatever you do, don't mess with the pancreas. And with that, we bring this episode to a close. As always, I would like to thank the California University of Science and Medicine Administration for supporting this podcast, as well as Dr. Spartz for talking with us today. Similarly, I would like to shout out Jude Bonahani, Sydney Cummings, and Dr. V. Hahn, who lead the collective podcast effort. And finally, I would like to thank the members of our specific writing group podcast team who contributed to this episode, from our team leader, Taylor Baranski, our researchers, Arshdeep Kaur, Trinity Van, Joshua Mandap, and Darshan Chandramohan, who also pulled double duty as our editor for this episode. And likewise, thanks to Miguel Villanueva, who stepped in to co-host today. Without their work, none of this is possible. Signing off, adjacent to the currently mid-construction COSM recording studio, this has been Henry Tranton. Thank you for listening, and let's do this again sometime.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you have any questions, comments, or episode suggestions, please email us at oumpodcast@cusm.org. That's oumpodcast@cusm.org.